Off in the salty ocean, off where the waves roll free. The sparkling water rises, then crashes to the sea. Out amongst the breakers, you'll have no need to fear. It's true, it's the blue frontier.
Welcome to a new episode of Rising Tide, the Ocean Podcast. This is David Helvarg, and my co-host is Vicki Nichols Goldstein of the Inland Ocean Coalition, which is a voting bloc, if you think about it.
We like to think of it that way, too.
Today, we're talking about the ocean and the elections with Mark Spaulding, the president of the Ocean Foundation. Mark's an expert on international ocean law and policy, and also deeply involved in the blue economy and understand the impact of politics on our public seas and communities. So today's blue news you can use is that there's an election coming up in less than 6 weeks. It's going to have a huge impact on our coasts and oceans and our lives from sea to shining seas. Let's just jump into our conversation. Mark, why do you think neither the Harris-Waltz campaign or the Trump-Vance campaigns really spoken about climate change or ocean-related environmental issues to date?
So, David, thanks for inviting me, first of all. And according to the Environmental Voter Project, environmentalists don't vote. 8 million skipped the last presidential election. 13 million skipped the midterm election in 2022. The League of Conservation Voters doesn't score ocean votes for us in the ocean community. And the Ocean Champions Group has been disbanded. Climate-motivated voters make up 37% of registered voters, 60 million people. But they're not consistent voters either. So why should either campaign talk to them? They're making this election about women's rights, abortion, democracy and voters' rights, freedom versus authoritarianism, price gouging, income disparity due to neoliberal policy, diversity, equity, inclusion, justice, and access versus white Christian nationalism, and about a prosecutor against a criminal. If we want to talk about the election in the context of climate and environment, there's a lot to say.
There is a lot to say. We really need to start talking about this very important component.
And also, we don't have a direct democracy like a lot of nations. We have this electoral college. So our 40 million votes here in California means much less than Arizona's or Pennsylvania, where Harris is very insistent that she's for fracking after an earlier period when she was against it. So energy issues aren't national, they're local, and perhaps ocean issues as well. I was looking through YouTube today at some direct quotes that are confirmable from Harris and from Trump. So let me just read you a few. This is from Harris last year addressing a NOAA gathering in Florida. He said, "Natural infrastructure, which reduces the impact of storm surges and hurricanes, is really important. And that natural infrastructure is often more effective than concrete barriers and retaining walls. In the Gulf of Mexico, we'll restore oyster reefs. That'll not only diminish the impact of tropical storms and hurricanes and clean our oceans by filtering out polluted runoff from our cities. It all makes sense and it works. It's very doable. And that's why I'm optimistic about all this." This is the day she was announcing $562 million for coastal restoration. So clearly she knows her stuff. Two quotes from Donald Trump this year. One's, "I make this pledge to be to the great people of America. We will drill, baby, drill. We will do it at all levels no one's seen before. We'll pay off our debts and lower taxes this way." So we know where he's going to be on offshore drilling. On offshore wind, "Never understood wind. Tremendous amounts of fumes and everything, whether it's made in China, Germany. They make them and put them up. And if you have any windmills near your home, congratulations. Your house just went down 75% in value. Windmills are also causing whales to die in numbers never seen before. Nobody does anything about it. Windmills are driving them crazy. They're driving the whales, I think, a little batty."
Total contrast. One person who seems to know what they're talking about and the other person who doesn't know what they're talking about at all. We know that Trump, when he was president before, withdrew us from the Paris Agreement. We know that his former administration members are behind Project 2025, which calls for further withdrawals from international agreements related to climate and the environment. Project 2025 dismantles NOAA, which is about how we monitor our weather, including hurricane warnings.
National Oceanographic and Atmospheric Administration.
It deals with weather, fisheries, and all of our ocean and atmospheric research. It also calls for the dismantling of the Environmental Protection Agency. It reduces funding for renewable energy. It ends all kinds of programs that address climate change. But perhaps as insidious as anything, it calls for firing independent, nonpartisan civil servants and replacing them with loyalists to Trump. This is a recipe for environmental and climate disaster.
Let's drill down on some of these topics, because you just threw out a whole number of very big and daunting directions that this administration will take us in under Project 2025.
Go Vicky, drill baby, drill.
So you started out, Mark, with the list, with our commitment to the Paris Agreement. And I'd just like to talk a little bit about that. So how would that affect the United States with our international relationships if we were to pull out or could not really follow through with our commitments on the Paris Agreement?
Our country has the biggest economy in the world. Therefore, we are the biggest contributor to greenhouse gases and biggest contributor to global warming on the planet. We need to be leaders in reducing our emission of greenhouse gases. We need to be leaders in removing legacy carbon from the atmosphere. We need to be leaders in helping other countries do the same. And that's what the Paris Agreement really, when you fundamentally boil it down to, is all about, how each country can make their own individual commitments. Trump pulled us out of it. Biden put us back in. Trump is now proposing to pull us back out another time. Our credibility will be diminished on top of everything else in terms of making something happen on climate change if we keep this rotating door going.
And that's maybe the most important, because climate is just overwhelming other issues in terms of impacts on our lands and our seas. But there are other international agreements. There's the need to ratify the High Seas Treaty. There's the deep sea mining issue, the marine protected areas. Maybe you could just say a bit on what that might look like under two different regimes.
We have a network of international agreements related to the environment, the Basel Convention, the plastics treaty that's under negotiation, the ones that you just mentioned. The U.S. has a long-standing history of being a leader in a lot of these agreements and being the country that helps finance getting something done, contributes to the secretariats of these agreements so that they are actually successful. And Trump basically doesn't understand what that network means for collaboration and cooperation among all of the countries of the world, doesn't understand how to leverage the United States funding and influence to get good things done.
And what about Harris?
She has demonstrated in her travels as vice president, a true internationalist understanding, and has developed excellent relationships with leaders around the world, which is something that I think Biden has tremendous strength in himself. In fact, one of the best presidents we've ever had in terms of his personal relationships with other world leaders. And I think she has learned and is ready as a result of her travels and conversations. So I don't think there's any risk of her pulling the rug out from underneath the U.S.'s leadership on international agreements and commitments.
I think there is, maybe there's a perspective, collaboration, cooperation for suckers. Clearly, the Trump approach is completely transactional. We bought Alaska, why can't we buy Greenland? But in practice, in policy, they had flotillas in the last election, 2020, flotillas of recreational boaters out for Trump, flotillas for Trump. And I know there are recreational boaters who just see it as an experience, jet skiers and the like, and don't think about what historic healthy oceans look like. But there's a deep policy level where Harris is coming out of almost 4 years of a Biden administration that's passed the first and most significant climate act, that's applying it to coasts and oceans, that has a track record. And the Trump administration also has a track record of trying to open all offshore waters to oil and gas, essentially seeing the ocean as a gas station and a garbage dump.
Unleashing all of America's energy resources is a direct quote. So there's really no concern for the environmental impact of that approach. It's just same thing, drill, baby, drill.
And the economic consequences in terms of just the growth that NOAA tracks, and maybe this is another reason they want to get rid of NOAA. It's been tracking billion-dollar plus extreme weather events, which have quadrupled in the last decade, and that they're up about 40 times from what the baseline used to be of damage. And the damage we're seeing, I just got back from New England. We've lost our kelp forest here in California, 95% of them north of the Golden Gate. But nobody seems aware that the kelp forest have collapsed in New England, also because of warming oceans.
So, David, let me address two things that you just said. One, yes, they want to get rid of contrarian voices to their climate denial, their view that climate is a hoax, their view that we need to be expanding, not contracting, our use of oil and gas. This is the result of years of Republican activities. It used to be in Washington, D.C., both parties agreed that there was a problem and they might bring a different solution to that problem. But if you deny the problem even exists, then you don't have to offer a solution. And so this is the new effort that they are making that really shuts all of this down. But the second thing I wanted to address that you just mentioned was Harris coming out of 4 years of Biden and the accomplishments that he's made. The problem is many voters, even including Democrat voters, seem awfully unaware of the current administration's efforts on climate change. The legislation is excellent. The Inflation Reduction Act from 2022 represents the largest federal climate change investment in U.S. history. It has tax credits for households to reduce energy costs, funding for cleaner energy production, incentives to lower carbon emissions. The Infrastructure and Investment Jobs Act also includes a bunch of climate provisions. We can also list off executive actions and other things that have been done by this administration. And we started this conversation by saying, why aren't we talking about this? And Harris and Biden actually have a lot to talk about and should be talking about it. But like I said, they don't, you know, think that's who they have to worry about talking to for votes and hope that everybody knows this and assumes it. But I think it's underknown.
I agree. I have lots of conversations with colleagues and family, and they're not really aware of it. And we've already seen a lot of the benefits coming through with just the incentives and minor little things that neighborhoods could even take advantage of, EV bicycles. And
we just got $3 million. We helped our port here in Richmond, California, sort of small port in a poor community. We got $3 million to electrify the dockage here, clean up the port. That's $3 million out of $3 billion that's going for cleaner ports and shipping.
And a huge amount of that money is going to red states and benefiting red states and creating jobs in red states. And so some of this credit has to go where it's due. And nobody's turning that money away. Nobody's turning those jobs away. Nobody's doing anything to stop this except Trump's threats to turn it, reverse it when he gets in office. And I don't know that even Republican governors in red states want to reverse it at this point.
So with Project 2025, they really just want to repeal the whole act, which seems crazy because there's a lot of funding already that's being shipped out to states and all of these incentives. Do you understand how that could even work if you repeal the Inflation Reduction Act? What happens to all that money that has been allocated?
So most of the money that is already moved is committed. It can't be clawed back. It would be future monies that would be stopped, future activities that would be stopped, tax credits stopped, things like that stopped. But there's a set of rules, administrative rules, on what can be reviewed by a new administration, and there's a date set for that. Trump seems to have absolutely complete disregard for rules and believe the rules do not apply to him. And so he might try and claw back these things, but I'm relatively confident that a lot of things that are already in place, already been spent, already been committed, are irrevocable at this point.
And I think one clarification is, just as Donald Trump's twisting himself into a pretzel on abortion because he realizes his anti-abortion stance is very unpopular, he and other Republicans are running away from Project 2025, which was put together by the Heritage Foundation. The people who put Project 2025 together were basically putting a policy for Trump, who's not a policy guy, to implement. And this is the traditional intellectual leadership of the Republican Party. When they talk about abolishing NOAA, when they talk about charging for privatizing the weather service, clearly nobody wants to have to pay to find out if there's a tornado or a hurricane headed your way.
Project 2025, imagine anything that you care about, and it's probably against it. Clean water ought to be something that everyone has a right to. Clean drinking water ought to be something we all have a right to. We have a Clean Water Act. We have a Clean Drinking Water Act. Both of them were passed and signed by a Republican president. Both of them responded to serious concerns about how clean our water was not, both for drinking and for other uses. We don't want to go backwards. I don't understand why anybody's advocating for going back to contaminated water, contaminated drinking water. It doesn't even make any logical sense. I think the problem here is a set of ideologies around the government is the problem. The government is preventing commerce. The government is preventing something else that has morphed to a, we hate everything, right? This is a hate-filled document and a hate-filled campaign and doesn't actually stand for anything, right? We could have a conversation that the federal agencies have overreached, which is part of the Chevron case, and should be curbed in managing how they do things or not. We could have a debate about that if we were willing to talk about how regulations are made, how regulations are enforced, and all of that sort of thing. But that's not what's happening here. We're not having a civil and reasonable discussion about how clean drinking water is managed. We're saying, let's get rid of the agencies and the rules and let everybody be damned. And it's going to cut funding to states for water programs. It's going to cut funding to NGOs for water programs. It's going to cut federal agency funding for water programs. It is a recipe for disaster, which means we'll have to start all over again and figure out how to clean up the water this time.
We've moved from having disagreements about how to address problems to denying problems in reality. And reality doesn't go away. The talk and the bluster of the Trump-Vance campaigns about is we'll pretend reality isn't reality. We'll move forward with this sort of idealized vision of what America used to be, somehow greater than it is today. And I think Harris's joy may be overstated. You can't be that joyful about getting to statistically even chances of winning. But there's that sense of the future versus the past.
There's no reason why this election should even be close. There is no reason why a supremely qualified woman is not way ahead of a criminal who has no qualifications for holding this job, other than the rhetoric of hate and division that he has repeatedly sowed across the country.
And that's why we have you on, Mark, because you have no strong opinions.
None at all.
So we've spent the majority of this conversation talking about the things we don't like about Project 2025 and how that is going to take us backwards and how it's really going to reduce the ability for us to enjoy the ocean, have clean air, clean water, basically let corporations take over. Let's shift it a little bit. How do we get the environment and the ocean into the conversations? How do we help make that bridge so people are going, wow, I didn't realize we would be losing that if we vote for Trump? Because that seems to be the biggest challenge, getting people who care about the environment to vote pro-ocean, pro-environment. What can we do?
I just heard from one organizer. He's got a program specifically focused on potential climate voters, and they're looking at those battleground states. They've identified like 400,000 people who put climate as their number one priority. They have no interest in convincing anybody otherwise. What they're doing is they're calling those people. They're even using psychology. They're saying, are you going to vote in November? Most people want to have a positive image of themselves. They say yes. They're now calling them back saying, remember when you said you'd vote in the election? We know you're an honest person. You couldn't have been lying to us. So we're going to help you get out there and vote for climate. It's shocking what Mark originally said, which is people who care about the environment and climate tend not to be active voters. And you can't really care about something if you can't get it implemented. And in this country at this point, you cannot implement it unless you're willing to do the minimum you need to do as a citizen, which is get out there and vote for what you believe in.
If the statistics from the Environmental Voter Project are correct, there's millions of votes to be had here. And those folks hopefully are knowledgeable enough to choose the candidate who is going to do well by the environment and do well by doing something to address climate change. So we have to just convince them to actually show up for a change. What does it take to get them to show up? Is that kind of repeat phone calls? Let's do that. Is it shaming them a little bit for failing to show up in the midterm and the last presidential election? Is it linking every time we say this election's about women's rights, it's about women's rights and the climate? Is it every time? And the planet.
Which is mostly blue.
Which you're right. And how do we get those folks who are, shall we say, inconsistent voters to be there, to show up, to be engaged, right? We know since Kamala accepted the nomination that there's been a huge upswing in voter registrations. Most of those have been women. A lot of them have been women of color. There's a lot to be said for getting women to turn out, given the draconian women approach, reversals for women that is draconian in Project 2025, to get those folks to show up. What's the equivalent for those who are motivated to vote for climate, addressing climate change? What do we do? What do we say to them? We can talk about the record of the Biden-Harris administration. We can talk about the threats from Project 2025. That'll probably carry us a little bit, but knowing is not sufficient, right? I know that I should eat less and exercise more, but that doesn't mean I do it. We need to actually change behavior. We need people to get off of their chair and go show up and vote, and or ask them why they're not doing it.
I just don't think that the major media outlets are even touching on these topics. And I'm wondering, what could we do, a big collaboration with lots of the folks in the ocean world, the scientists and the nonprofits, to say,
I know,
get some coverage on CNN about how important the ocean is to this election, or
maybe we could do a podcast.
What a great idea.
It's true. There's, on the one hand, there's actual ocean policy that's there that people don't know about. On the other hand, Trump has this weird abhorrence of sharks, and Vance's VP is into dolphin porn. If you don't believe me, Google it.
That's interesting.
It's something we have to, it's a horse race. That's how the corporate major media are covering it. But there's a lot of other media out there. We're one voice in the wilderness, but it's a wilderness worth protecting. And I think we have to reach out. And I do. I know somebody who's instinctually pro-Trump, but he's also an ocean guy, and he understands he can't really vote for a guy who wants to open it all for offshore drilling and tear down offshore wind. This will be out in September. We got to talk to everybody we know who expresses interest in the environment and say it's a survival issue at this point. We signed on to a treaty that said we can't go above 1.5 degrees Celsius or we're already overshooting.
Supposedly, according to the newspapers, President Trump's advisors are urging him to talk about policy, urging him to talk about the inflation and economic policy and all sorts of other things. And he's not doing it. He is a feral animal who's trapped in a corner, and his instinct is to try and undermine Harris by insult. That's his favorite tool in the toolbox. He wields it constantly, and he can't stay on message in a policy conversation. Harris, meanwhile, is very willing to talk about policy, but the list that I started this conversation with are things that are more front of mind for voters, seem to be carrying the day: women's rights, abortion, democracy, etc. So she's talking about those. We can add to this conversation by pointing out that they're not talking about the environment. They're not talking about climate.
I think summer in U.S. world history.
Exactly. I do think the media does us a little bit of disservice, right? In the Democratic National Convention and the acceptance speeches, Kamala did mention climate change and did talk about it as an issue, but she only mentioned it once. So instead of celebrating that a presidential nominee talked about climate change in their acceptance speech, we said, oh, this is terrible. She only mentioned it once. We're not doing ourselves any favors. The media is not doing us any favors by diminishing the issue by calling out how little it's mentioned rather than celebrating when it is mentioned. And that's part of our problem.
We're all doing our part to bring this topic around and out, and I guess we'll continue to do stress. Maybe we can all write a letter to the campaign.
And we all just have to report the science. Science isn't partisan. I think part of the media problem is they think if they report extreme weather, but they're afraid if they link it to climate, they'll be seen as partisan because one of our two major parties is denying the science. That's not the way you report. That's not good journalism. Sometimes good journalism is just having conversations like this and hoping that people who are listening will do the minimum, which is vote for the coast, vote for the ocean, and talk to others who care about our survival from sea to shining sea.
And who doesn't love the ocean? Just bringing the ocean into the conversation. So many ways that we can protect the ocean. Take that positive approach. And with that, I want to thank you, Mark Spaulding, president of the Ocean Foundation, for being on the Rising Tide Ocean Podcast.
Thanks for having me. I enjoyed it very much.
Thank you. Rising Tide, the Ocean Podcast, is a production of Blue Frontier, co-hosted by Blue Frontier's David Helbard and Vicki Nichols Goldstein of the Inland Ocean Coalition, with production support from Holden Hardcastle of Fluid Studios, Natasha Benjamin, and Nick Paz, and editing services provided by Charles Landon of Studio Cape May. You can find Rising Tide at bluefront.org or on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you download your podcast. And don't forget to recommend the Rising Tide Ocean Podcast to your friends and other ocean lovers.
Off in the salty ocean, off where the waves roll free. The sparkling water rises, then crashes to the sea. Out amongst the breakers, you'll have no need to fear. It's true, it's the Blue Frontier. Off in the salty ocean, off to the Blue Frontier.
Sparky, come here, buddy. Sparky. There you are. Good boy, Sparky.